Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Annie Lloyd is founder of the Buffalo Gals, who hosts the Living Our Legacy Conference this week in Rapid City. She's joining us now from the SDPB studios in Rapid. Annie, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you, Lori. I'm happy to be here.
It's nice to have you here. I'm pretty sure you've got a busy week, so thanks for taking time.
Thanks for having us.
Tell me about the Buffalo Gals, and then we'll talk about the conference itself.
I was gone from South Dakota for about 30 years. I'm a fifth-generation South Dakotan raised in Rapid City, and when I came back home, I noticed that the same things that were going on 30 years ago were still continuing. So many women in our community weren't talking to each other. They didn't know one another. The engineering students and engineers and teachers up at South Dakota School of Mines didn't know many of the people in our community. Artists didn't know the bankers. And so I gathered a group of women together a couple years ago, about 60 of them, and they all showed up. And people said, well, how did you get them there? And I said, well, we invited them. And Buffalo Gals honors the grit, guts, and grace in all of us women that have a desire to get things moving in our community and just get things done, oftentimes from behind the scenes. We have conversations and seek to develop deeper relationships with one another.
Annie, had you been somewhere in that 30 years where you saw women talking to each other and had a sense of what could happen that you brought back to Rapid City?
I did. That's a great question. I spent 10 years in Los Angeles. During that time, the riots went on after the Rodney King incident. Sure. And I saw women come together in South Central LA and help rebuild LA. And then when I moved over to Phoenix for over 20 years, I saw through immigration reform and so many different challenges that Phoenix had experienced and overall in Arizona, women coming together in circles and conversation sought to address that deepest aspect of that dis-ease that we experience in community of separation. And oftentimes there's two groups. One wants to do a project, and the other group of people realize that when we sit down and get to know one another, have conversations with one another, we develop these deeper relationships that lead to amazing solutions that emerge out of the community that we never even saw coming.
So tell me that moment you sort of step out of the car and see Rapid City again after 30 years. Maybe you've been back a few times. I don't know.
I had been.
And you look around and you say, well, it's some of the same old stuff. What sort of problems were you seeing? Just the fact that women didn't connect, or were there other problems and issues that you also saw really that you thought that connection could serve?
One of the things that I saw right away was a newspaper article about the depth of suicide that was occurring in our community, the concerns about meth, drug abuse, drug addiction, the racism that was going on in the community, the misunderstanding about cultural traditions. Those tensions seemed to be greater than they'd ever been before. And I had attended so many different gatherings and had interviewed more than 200 women after I'd come home just to figure out what was going on. I came home to take care of my mom, so I had a lot of time on my hands. And when I listened to women said that the thing that they missed the most was being able to have other women to talk to, that they felt alone in their ventures and their entrepreneurial ventures and their nonprofit experiences, and wanted to get to know other people that had similar experiences and were having a difficult time doing that. They didn't want those typical networking events. They found them to lack depth and weight.
Okay, so let's get to that. What's the difference between a typical networking event for women and an event that has depth and weight? And then let's talk about this conference this week.
What we try to provide at the Buffalo Gals is an environment that spurs creativity, that encourages conversation beyond exchanging business cards. We ask you to share about you, about your dreams and passions beyond. Maybe your passion is what you are doing. Oftentimes, though, we go to work for 8 hours, and then we take other time out of our day to live our passions out. And so our jobs often define us, and that's what we believe is different between other networking groups, per se, and what the Buffalo Gals offers. We also encourage the support of different organizations that are starting up in our community that have been in existence for a long time that people didn't even know about. So, for example, we've helped out the Girl Scouts at different times. As well as inviting the Backyard Coalition on Suicide Prevention to come to some of our meetings, supporting MOA and the Ambassadors Group. So introducing people in the community. We just had an event down at Racing Magpie Studios. So we brought this group of women down there that had never experienced what they were doing down there and creating this amazing cultural community center.
All right, Living Our Legacy. It's my guest today. If you're just joining us, you're listening to In the Moment. My guest is from the Buffalo Gals. Her name is Annie Lloyd. And they're having a conference, Living Our Legacy. It is March 2nd through the 4th at the Rushmore Plaza Holiday Inn. Annie, tell me about Living Our Legacy.
This is our second conference. The International Women's Day, of course, is celebrated throughout the world. It's been going on for many, many decades. And March 4th has been a date in the calendar that I have found ironic because it's the only verb in the calendar. So if you think of March 4th,
sure.
And so it has a particular energy to it, right? So this is our second annual conference. Last year we had almost 300 women that attended. It's a diverse group. So everybody from bankers and lawyers and entrepreneurs to stay-at-home moms and artisans, women from Pine Ridge, Rosebud, Eagle Butte, Parmalee come up, as well as, of course, the Black Hills region. Joining together on Thursday evening, we kick off with a new gathering this year in honoring seven women who have worked diligently behind the scenes to bring community together, truly reaching across and building bridges of connections, and have been a voice for change. Women like Karen Mortimer, Paula Long Fox, Heather Pickering, Rowdy Brewick, Cecilia Firethunder, and Marnie Herman. And on Friday, then, we have this conference of 10 speakers. They speak for about 12 minutes apiece. There'll be three speakers and then a 45-minute breakout where the women get to have a conversation, an extended conversation, about what they just listened to, the inspirational words that they experienced. The women, instead of speaking about what business or organization, they're talking about themselves, what their life was like, what moment in their life spurred them to make a shift and then live out this passion that they are living out today and sharing their experience, strength, and hope. And then Saturday is this community conversation to bring it together to say, what are the resources that you as women with these passions that you have need that you're not getting in the community? Not that Buffalo Gals can address that, but so that we can all collectively share our stories. And oftentimes out of that, a woman will say, oh my gosh, I know somebody, let me introduce you to them.
Now, I know men are welcome and yes, invited, but give me an idea of what just that conversation amongst women, after hearing some speakers, for example, you know, what's the potential of that 45 minutes, really?
What we experience is women's history has always been shared orally. So it's hard to find women's history written down. And when we listen to a woman speak, we hear in her oftentimes bits and pieces of our own story. We'll listen to her and go, oh my gosh, that's it. She's able to express words that we can then relate to ourselves that we weren't able to find those words to describe our experience at the time, or hear somebody share something that is so personal and intimate that we were hesitant to share that before. And that emerges in those individual conversations around the table after the speakers share their stories of inspiration and grit, guts, and grace.
Women's history has always been shared orally. I don't know that I've ever thought of it that way.
Mm-hmm.
Dig a little deeper into that. I'm thinking of my grandma now.
Well, think about those times that, you know, as a woman growing up here in this region, still as preparing for the conference, I can remember just in the last couple of days, us sitting around and making some ceremonial regalia, the stories that came up of grandmother and her challenges of being raised in a boarding school, other women's stories of peeling potatoes in the kitchen and the stories that were shared, those moments in time that you learned about how to make an apple pie, or did you know about this story that happened that wasn't talked about at the dinner table? That's how women's history has been shared over the years.
This is why I decided to learn how to cook. And I cook very poorly. But I remember being at the age where you finally realized that the action was happening in the kitchen.
Yes.
And that is where the stories were coming out. And
exactly.
I think we told this story at Thanksgiving, but my grandmother would just, when she couldn't cook the dressing anymore, she had it all memorized. You know, she just did it by smell and experience. Mm-hmm. I remember standing at the stove and her, you know, taking a sniff and saying, "Nope, you need more of this." And I was like, "Can I write that down, please? Because I'm never going to remember it like she did." Do we need to write those stories down, Annie? Not just the recipes, but some of that oral history. Does it need to be written down?
I think that it does. And Gemma Lockhart is one of our speakers. Of course, she comes from this region and in the media. She's coming up from Colorado to share her story on Friday. And, of course, much of what she records is through video. And that brings an aspect. It's like a recipe in our community. When the stories of women, of our grandmothers, of all the women whose shoulders that we stand upon are missing, in our dialogue, in our daily dialogue, we're missing so much of what's happening in our community. Buffalo Gals noticed, I noticed, when I came home, there was a bank in town that had no women on their board of directors. And this is not about being against men by any aspect. This is about the fact that when women aren't at the table, our best opportunities to move forward in a healthy and constructive manner, those best opportunities are not being presented at the time. And so how do we change that, right?
So when we look at an issue like meth or suicide, how can women getting together in conversation begin to have an impact on that in a community?
Well, I'll share a little personal story with you. I've been sober for 24 years. And one of the things, so when I grew up here, I was one of those typical teenagers that grew up, drank a lot, and got into a bit of challenges over the years. And I learned that that disease of suicide, of meth, of drug addiction and alcoholism is a disease of separation. And so when we come together in community, in conversation, we get to know one another. We get to know one another's stories. We feel more connected. And when we feel more connected, those wounds begin healing, and we can have deeper and greater compassion for one another and the challenges that all of us are facing, because we may be able to look great on the outside, and I was able to accomplish that for years. And yet on the inside, I felt so different than and separated from and alone and afraid and didn't have the necessary tools to be able to address the challenges that I was facing in life. And it was through conversations with women and developing these deeper relationships that I personally was able to heal and witness so many other people being able to heal. And so I've witnessed this alchemy, this magic, this beautiful miracle that can occur when we get together and are willing to spend time with one another, being uncomfortable and yet ironically feeling safe because of that environment that we are intentionally creating.
So we have to be honest then. We can't just, goes back to that sort of, it's beyond networking. It's really a deep conversation where you're not afraid to show up. We've got about a minute left, Annie. How do you create a safe space for somebody to show up with a personal story of a shift or, you know, something in their background that they can bring into a circle of women and men who are, you know, willing to receive it?
You asked a perfect question, because it boils down to three things. The how of it is, can we be honest? Are we open-minded? And are we willing to have a shift in perspective? Are we willing to look at something differently in this moment than we have in the past? I used to think that the worst thing that could happen was for me to be an alcoholic. It turned out to be one of the greatest gifts that I could have ever received, because my life changed dramatically as a result of it. That's what we're asking people to consider when we sit down in conversation. Are you willing to be honest, open-minded, and willing to have a shift in perspective?
Annie Lloyd is with the Buffalo Gals. Living Our Legacy runs from March 2nd to March 4th at the Rushmore Plaza Holiday Inn. Any last words on the conference itself, Annie? Price and tickets?
Tickets for Friday and Saturday remain at $9.
Wow.
And
that's right? A deal right there.
Well, So average wage for women in the state of South Dakota is $9. That's why we do that. You can get your tickets at buffalogals.us. Tickets are still available. You can show up at the door that day. We'll greet you with a big hug and welcome you to coming. I'm so appreciative of y'all taking the time to bring this forward to people, and we hope to see many people there and continue this conversation, Lori.
Well, I can't give you a big hug from across the river, but someday I'll get over there.
I look
get out
to
there
it.
About once a month. I'll look you up, and I'll cash that rain check in. Annie Lloyd, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Lori.
Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Several years ago, while working for a Sioux Falls TV station, Christian Begeman paid special attention to South Dakota's scenery while traveling with a news crew. One thing that stood out to him was the large number of country churches, many in beautiful condition. 15 years later, Begeman began an online photo series for South Dakota Magazine. Some of his photos, along with his story, Light in the Darkness, Salt of the Earth, appear in the March-April issue of South Dakota Magazine. Joining us now from Sioux Falls to tell us about this interesting project, Christian Begeman. Christian, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So tell me that moment where you were sort of in the car. Where were you? Do you remember geographically in the first church that you sort of thought, that is worth taking a picture of?
Yes, I can tell you exactly. And actually, there was a couple different instances. It's Zion Lutheran, south of Hartford, South Dakota. And I just remember going out on stories with reporters, and we would drive by and thinking, wow, that looks really cool. But the one I specifically remember was there was a big storm that came through, and Nancy Nay from KSFI and I were sent out to, because we had somebody called in that particular steeple was blown over, and we had a heck of a time finding it because it's not on the main road. It's kind of off on gravel a mile or two, but once we found it and shot the story, that always stuck with me. And that was actually when I got my first digital and fancy camera. That was one of the first churches that I went out and shot at sunset, was Zion Lutheran.
So how hard was it to find it again?
Oh, easy.
once you found it was easy to get back.
Yeah, and in fact, I don't know if I want to promote Google on your show or not, but Google Maps really helped me a lot, finding the country churches in the area. I could, kind of zoom into a county and type in church, and it actually helped me out a lot. So
smart. So how many of these churches have you been able to capture on, I say film, but maybe that's not the word to use anymore, but capture the image of?
Well, I counted it up probably last fall, and I think, I should have that number in front of me, but I don't. But I think it was around 300 to 400 in South Dakota, and then another, 20 to 30 in the neighboring states, whether it was Nebraska, Minnesota. I even got one in Montana and a couple up in North Dakota. So,
does it get old?
No, it doesn't.
New each time, right? Yeah, because I'm not tired of looking at the images at all. Each one has its own personality, their characters.
Yeah, and there's different denominations and different styles, and I particularly like the old Norwegian style with the straight steeple in the front, but that's not to say that some of the other ones that are a little, a little different aren't as beautiful, and really I like to, you asked if it gets old, and it kind of doesn't, because I try to go out as the weather changes, and South Dakota's weather never gets old, and it's always new or different. So whether it's a sunset or a night sky or a blue sky day with white puffy clouds, that's kind of what keeps it fresh for me.
So let's talk about the process then of sort of picking where you're going to go and when, because you don't know when you get there if there's going to be white puffy clouds or a storm. Is it serendipity involved, or are you planning it out?
Typically, I do my big drives on a weekend, and so a lot of it is just, stuff that I can't control. However, I do keep very close eye on weather, whether it's the local news stations, apps, and I also watch, what's called space weather, too, because I've been able to capture a few of the churches with northern lights, and that's those are the times that are, I mean, that are truly are amazing, where you stand out alone in the night sky watching the northern lights flicker over a church, and you're just like in awe. I'm not that much of a emotional guy, but I've physically said out loud, "Wow," many times. happening to capture a steeple with northern lights. Now, yeah. You can also with the Milky Way in the summertime too on a clear night. It's very beautiful as well. And South Dakota is blessed with, beautiful night skies because we don't have as much light pollution, specifically as you go west into the state.
So you're capturing something not only with the night sky that might not always be that way, and you're capturing some architecture and buildings with a story that might go away some way. Are these rural churches surviving?
I would say they are dwindling, I think is probably the best way to put it. There are a few that are going very strong, and particularly they're closer to a big community. But there are also very many out in the more rural areas that are closed or only used during special events like a wedding or a funeral or a summer celebration. But there are also many that are coming down. Since I started watching in the last 4 or 5 years, I can think of 6 churches that are no longer standing. And sometimes it's a good lesson for me because there was one in Hamlin County that I found in the summertime that was surrounded by trees. And I'm like, oh, this would be a great place to come back in the fall. I get back up there in the fall to get the fall colors, and it was gone. It was just a field. So, I think, like I said, dwindling is a better word. However, there are a few that are very vibrant and fun. And then when I post them on the Facebook page, you hear back from folks sharing them with their friends, talking about Vacation Bible School or talking about who the pastor was and all that. And so it's kind of fun to read through that too.
If you're just joining us, we're talking to photographer Christian Begeman. He has a story and photos in this month's issue of South Dakota Magazine, beautiful spreads to look at there. And Christian, I'm wondering about your childhood and if there's a connection to Vacation Bible School and a rural church. What's your background?
Yeah, I grew up south of Isabel, South Dakota, along the Moro River on the Zeebock and Dewey County line. I like to call it God's country. Not a lot of people have driven through there, but when they do, they usually have an impression one way or the other. There's not a lot of country churches out there. We went to church in town, Isabel Baptist Church. And Isabel, which now has a population of roughly 200 when all the farmers come in for lunch, they had at the time 6 active churches. I think they're down to maybe 4 now.
Wow.
But so a lot of the churches were in town. But, we every Sunday and often Wednesday nights and special holidays, mom and dad would pack us 4 boys up and we'd go into church. And, those were where our first friends were made. Every other Sunday was potluck. And that's where I first learned to love, banana and Jell-O concoctions, as well as deer sausage and all the stuff, and we would sit downstairs and just visit or play or whatever. So yeah, it was a very, very big part of me growing up.
My mom used to pass us hard candy during church. There was 4 of us too, just to shut us up and keep us content. And to this day, I remember every time I unwrap hard candy, I try to do it as quietly as possible because that was a skill that I developed as a child.
That reminds me, we had an usher that would give us little kids when we came in candy as we came in. And
well,
I remember to this day that one time he didn't have any candy and I stood there. I was pretty little and waited with my hand out. And of course, that was the wrong thing to do.
That's not right.
Quickly picked me up and brought me to the pew.
Every church has a story. I know you said you're not very emotional, but I'm thinking of the baptisms and the funerals and the weddings. And do you hear? And you mentioned Facebook. What kind of stories are you hearing about the churches? Do you have any specifics of a specific church that you think you could share a compelling story about?
Well, there's so many, Much of it's superficial. It's like, hey, my grandma and grandpa went there. I mean, it's superficial for me to read. It means a lot to the people that post them because, they have relatives in a lot of these country churches have cemeteries right nearby. And they remember going there as a kid or when they visited South Dakota. There are very many followers on Facebook that are not from the Midwest. They are scattered throughout the country, and I think I even have followers as far away as Brazil.
Wow.
So it's just, you know, it's interesting to see some of the very specific things that I find interesting is when somebody will comment on a church that was built to look like what it looked like in the old country. I think of Sinksas, I think that's how you say it, Singsaas, up in Brookings County, has a twin church over in Norway that
really
looks just like it. Someday it would be pretty fun to go see that.
Don't you think? That's on your list of things to take pictures of, I bet. So you mentioned the Norwegian style. Tell me some about some of the architecture of these structures.
Well, you know, many of the churches are locked, so I don't get inside a lot, but I really can only comment on the outside ones. But it's just the straight, narrow, almost elegant steeple on the front, and anywhere from 3 to 5 windows on the side. You know, kind of just what you would picture in your mind if somebody says country church. And I think that's really what speaks to me the most. Now, sometimes I do get inside, and then typically those Lutheran church, they're usually Lutheran when they're Norwegian Lutheran, and they have beautiful big altars up front and, you know, wood pews, just like I remember growing up.
Do you draw a crowd when you're out there? Any curiosity, or are you out there by yourself, sort of just you and the church?
That's a good question. You know, I don't get a lot of people stopping by. I actually referenced this in the story in South Dakota Magazine. When I'm in some of the smaller towns, folks will wander by and wonder what I'm doing. And in fact, I actually sometimes that's how I get tours because they find out and they enjoy that their church is going to be, you know, get a photo of. And a lot of times people ask me to send them the photos afterwards or whatever too. So that's kind of fun to see. And they'll use them on their bulletin or print them up and have them hanging in their church. So that's always fun to be a part of too. But yeah, no, most of the time when I'm out there, I'm out at sunrise or sunset or, you know, after stormy weather or something. So there's not a lot of people out at the churches.
Yeah. How does it fit into, how does this project of photographing churches fit into your other work as a photographer?
Well, boy, that's a good question. You know, for me, it's kind of a getaway. It's kind of a release. It's something that I enjoy doing that doesn't feel like work, yet it is a way to get better at photography. So I guess that's how it fits in. It's like learning new techniques and processes, doing something that you feel really strong about, and then what I learn there, I can bring back to, you know, what I do here for Midco or what I shoot for landscapes and nature photography for the column that I do for South Dakota Magazine online.
Yeah. What have you learned as a photographer? Have you become a better photographer by going out and doing this?
Yes. I mean, it's a lot of it's technique stuff. So, like, in particular, the night shots, you know, you learn what kind of equipment you need to get those shots to work and how important focus is and how hard it is to get a focus when it's almost pitch black out. And the other thing is just facing your fears. You know, who normally would walk around in the middle of a country cemetery in the middle of a night? You know, that's not something normal people do. And, you know, you have to quell all the scary stories you've heard growing up as a kid and, you know, and really realize that it's just like being out there in the day. And actually, you know, once your eyes adjust, you can see fairly well. So it's that kind of thing that I take away from those experiences.
And you certainly don't want to go out there in the cemetery in the middle of the night and take a bad picture. So you got to get all of it has to sort of come together at once, I guess.
Yeah. And you know, you also have to kind of, one of the beautiful things is I've learned a lot about like astronomy, like where the Milky Way is going to be at what time of year, because that really makes a nice background, or the moon phases, you know, to shoot a full moon with a church or whatever. And the other thing is like, I remember being out at it's called the Old Brown Church up in Grant County. It's a historical Native American church that the historic society up there has kept up, but it's not used very often, a few weddings and whatnot. But I was out there shooting the Milky Way, and there was some lilac bushes behind me, and I heard rustling and rattling from there, and, you know, it freaked me out a little bit. And then it turns out it's just a raccoon. So it's just, you know, nature being nature. So
All right. You can see Christian's photos and read about his process in the March-April issue of South Dakota Magazine, Christian Begeman. And you can also find him on Facebook, right?
Yeah. You just go onto Facebook and search Prairie Sanctuaries. It should pop up for you.
Excellent. Thanks, Christian.
Thank you very much.
Welcome back to In the Moment. Hugh Weber returns with a fresh helping from the Potluck Society. You can download his podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. Hugh joins us now from the SDPB studios at the University of Sioux Falls. Hugh, welcome back.
Hi, Lori. How are you?
I'm good. I missed you last week. I had a little vacation time, and you brought Joe Bartman without me.
Oh, I know, and you missed out. You've got to look back on sdpbb.org and listen to those segments because Joe is extraordinary.
And I went back and listened to the podcast, so I got to hear some of Joe talking about the answers you need being in the people who show up.
That's a certain amount
of faith there.
That's right.
Are you finding that in your work with the Potluck Society, that the people who need to show up are showing up for you?
They are, and Ashley is actually, we're going to feature Ashley Hansen today. She's actually an example of that. So I hadn't told you the backstory, but I was sitting minding my own business, probably surfing Facebook, and an alert came up that Public Transformation, this really interesting art project, was going to happen in Rapid City. I did a little bit of background, and I realized that she had been in Granite Falls the night before, so she had to pass right through Sioux Falls. Mm-hmm. And so I sent her a message and just said, I'm really fascinated by what you're doing. Any chance you need a cup of coffee on the road? And we had the opportunity to sit down with her and two of the artists that she was traveling with. So they are showing up. That serendipity is a key part of what we're doing.
And you had never met her before?
No, just a fellow traveler on the road and someone on the path, someone that, she describes as working kind of at that intersection of art and community development, which is a very similar path to my own and the work with the Potluck Society. And so it was pretty fantastic.
All
but
right.
Maybe we should have her introduce herself.
Hello, I'm Ashley Hansen, and I am a theater artist that splits my time between Minnesota and Colorado. I have a theater company called Place-Based Productions, and most recently, I created a project called Public Transformation, which was an exploration of arts and community development in rural areas in a little yellow school bus to share stories and connect rural practitioners with each other across the country. For me, it was really the election that prompted the start of this project. I felt as someone who is based in an urban area that works primarily in rural communities, I had a job to do looking at the map of the urban-rural divide, which we all know existed, but then really, saw glaringly, obviously portrayed following this most recent election. There were so many sweeping statements that were being made and stereotypes that were being made in urban areas about ruralness and in ruralness about urban areas. And as somebody who kind of straddles that line and knows the falsehoods of these stereotypes, I knew I had a certain responsibility in this conversation. So, but I didn't quite know how to handle that or to tackle that or to approach that. And the way that I learn is by asking questions. And so I thought, well, why don't I just go talk to other people doing this work? And it started as really a personal pilgrimage. I was just going to pick a few communities on a road trip that I was already planning on going on. And I was just going to stop and have a chat. But after I started having conversations with some of my friends that became partners at Springboard for the Arts and Art of the Rural and Creative Exchange, they said, I think other people besides just you are going to be interested in this information. And if we're able to help support this, maybe we could consider it being a longer, more engaged process. So it became this 5-week long cross-country journey, cross-country and back again, where I visited 24 different communities with populations under 10,000 and met with artists working at the intersection of art and community development to hear their story and then also to ask them, how they see their role in this current political climate, if it has changed at all, if there were, new revelations, if they have plans for future engagement or involvement in that conversation. But it was also, for me to learn what practices are being used in the rural arts and community development field that aren't being shared at some of the national conferences, and then, you know, articles and features and things like that. You're trying to find the, like, not usual suspects and learn from them about their practice.
Hugh, what's that school bus like?
Well, it's funny. So here's the interesting thing. The poor school bus actually didn't make the entire trip with her. It was left along the roadside somewhere along the path. So she was in a van by the time that she got to me, her and her co-travelers. But it was an interesting idea, right? Just from a foundational level that she would see this opportunity. She had planned to take a trip, but that she would see this opportunity as an opportunity to explore and discover and follow her curiosity, but within the context of some cultural change in the U.S. It's pretty exciting.
Is it cultural change or something that she had just noticed about the culture that she really didn't know?
Well, I think that's a great point. I think maybe it's that there was a sudden spotlight on the cultural divide.
Right.
One thing that she shared deeper in the interview is this idea that we too often think of rural as some sort of deficient or lesser form of urban culture, as opposed to it being its own culture entirely. To the extent that we allow for a cultural appropriation to occur between rural and urban areas that otherwise would be criticized or at least critically examined, and that we don't do that between urban and rural.
So she allowed herself as an artist to see her own biases in some ways, because not everybody thinks that rural is deficient compared to urban.
Yeah, that's right. I think her own biases and the biases within her community of practice.
Yeah.
You know, she spends a lot of time in rural communities. Her work through Space Productions, which is the theater company, takes her to rural communities most often. And yet she was very quick to say, listen, I spent a handful of hours in these 20 plus communities. I don't know their culture. I don't know the backstory and the histories. I'm getting a small glimpse, and I'm insanely curious, and I want to represent that well. But to pretend like I'm an expert would be inaccurate.
And she puts it into action and packs the bus and then the van and and
yeah,
goes
well,
on the road. What is she hoping to accomplish? Does she have a goal, or is she just sort of open to whatever happens? Is this part of this unknowing and unlearning conversation?
Yeah, I think she becomes a cultural translator of sort. Her and I talked about that at length when we sat down here in Sioux Falls, of this role of being able to recognize that she doesn't understand the various aspects of the culture, but that she can hear the stories and attempt to understand them and most importantly share them. And so she's captured over 100 hours of content that will be exhibited in a variety of events and exhibitions this summer throughout the region. That I think is going to start that conversation. And when I asked her to provide us a point of action as part of the Potluck podcast, she said, you know, if you're in an urban area, you're within an hour of a rural area. And if you're in a rural area, you're maybe a little further than an hour
right?
from an urban area, but you can go to another rural community and come with fresh eyes and leave your biases kind of at home and explore and discover. She brought this idea that Joe Bartman shared, and Joe and Ashley are really mirrors in the Potluck episode this week. She brought this idea, or embraced this idea, of not knowing. And so I asked her, though, didn't that get harder as you went through this process? Once you had been to, say, 15 communities, didn't you start to develop a set of assumptions? And she answered that question in this next clip.
I think I became more knowing as I went, but I also didn't, because each community was so different. You know, whether you're in the Central Valley of California and you're looking at, you're talking with a farmer performer who is, you know, dealing with water issues, or you're on the border in Ajo, Arizona, in the desert, and you have artists addressing, you know, folks trying to cross the border. You have, you go to West Texas, and you're like in the middle of the oil fields. You go to the bayou in Louisiana. You're in the Appalachian Mountains in the coal fields. I mean, I didn't know anything about any of these places. I'm from northern Minnesota. I know a little bit about that. But I really had my eyes opened at each step of the way. Our tagline really throughout the trip became, we know nothing about America. Every time we'd get in the car and we've had this like awesome experience and this amazing interview, we would get in the car and just say, we know nothing about America. Oh my God, we're having our minds blown every step of the way. And it complicates and challenges, you know, so much of what you think you know and what you, you know, your experiences have been and how you think the world should work. But then, you know, you go and visit a struggling former coal community, and maybe your views on whether or not a coal mine should be open change slightly because you're talking with somebody who really needs that job. So it was more of a process of like unlearning and just listening, I think, more than anything.
We know nothing about America. I love that, Hugh. I love her willingness to sort of say that again and again and have you know, an openness to have her mind blown.
Yeah, it's a bold vulnerability as far as I'm concerned. You know, this idea of shedding the expertise you do have, the experience you do have, you know, she recognizes that she's spent and invested a lot of time in the past and over this adventure in rural America, but that there's still so little that she actually knows, and that actually abandoning that and unlearning what she thinks she knows is the first step towards a deeper understanding.
100 hours of content. What does that mean? What is she gathering?
So it's a lot of audio. It's a healthy amount of video. When we sat down, we had a wonderful conversation that was about to get started, and she realized that she hadn't been recording it, and so she started. It's, I think, in a number of different formats, some formal, some very informal. But I think she's really in the mess of it right now. You know, she's sitting now having finished this adventure, probably needing a good solid nap, and has got 100 hours of content to muddle through and to figure out how to share in a meaningful way. And, you know, something that I've struggled with and, you know, I've talked with you and others about is who her responsibility is to. Is it to the partners that she's worked with or herself in her own art? Is it to the person that she interviewed? Or is it, frankly, to the audience of people that aren't in rural communities? And to figure out how to find the right thread and who to be responsible to, I think, is the part of the process that she's in right now.
Her responsibility is to the story, maybe.
Maybe. And to the version of truth that she can best represent.
Uh-oh, the version of truth. Now we're in the weeds.
She brought an interesting example, and it was something that we left out of the conversation. But an interesting example of rural development and what it was looking like in terms of gentrification. And the person that she interviewed didn't necessarily see it that way, but as someone who was living in an urban area, what she recognized in it is what she would describe as gentrification. So the truth that would be in a rural community for that individual is very different than kind of the interpreted truth of someone that's seen that happen in urban areas.
So let's dig into this idea of culture and an urban culture versus a rural culture. What exactly does she mean?
I'm not completely certain. I'll admit that. I think that it's more the recognition that rural is merely not the absence of urbanity or of people. That a lack of population is not, you know, an end of the spectrum of urban. It's an entirely different spectrum. And not only that, but that each of these communities is so very different in and of itself. I think that, you know, we take an assumption based on culture, and if the culture is universal and shared, there's that lack of understanding or the dissonance can be very real. You know, after the election myself, and the great thing about Ashley is our conversation was not political and certainly wasn't partisan. But after the election myself, I went away from, you know, small town Milbank to Philadelphia and DC for my college years. And I had, you know, around 100 emails from classmates that were more progressive in their worldview. And they simply didn't understand what was happening out here. They didn't understand. You know, this is the conversation you had with John Lauck about, you know, Trump voters. Like there's this incredible divide. And if we try to view it through our own culture, if we try to assume the culture is exactly the same and one is just a variant of the other, it's really hard to reconcile. If we can get to the point where we can recognize that the cultures, in fact, may be different, I think there's something interesting that can happen in terms of understanding.
So how do you approach that? If you're going to work under the theory that there's an entirely different culture at work here, not just variations of the same thing, how do you approach it to, you know, hear others?
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be similar to the approach I would take if I was going to go spend a delightfully long weekend in South Africa. I wouldn't show up and assume that anything they did differently than we did here in Sioux Falls was somehow abhorrent or somehow a perversion or twist of culture. I would think, I'd be curious. I'd ask, why is that? Is that practice? Is that tradition? Is that simply you as an individual, or is that something more universal in terms of this country? We don't really do that within the U.S. Sometimes we'll even struggle to do that within larger metro areas. But certainly, the number of times I've had the great fortune of having close friends come out to the prairie with me, or I've gotten to visit other parts of the rural sphere, even other parts of the U.S. and in rural communities. And you can very quickly get to a place of judgment or at least dissonance if you don't approach it simply with curiosity. And I think that's the lesson that Ashley provides. I think that's the lesson that Joe Bartman pushes, is that it's when we shed that sense of knowing, we shed those answers, which are simply an end, simply a closure, we start to ask questions that move us forward.
Hugh, we've got just a couple minutes left, and I want to talk about these antidotes to apathy and where they sort of come from and why it's important for you to include them at the end of every podcast as action items.
Yeah, I listen to a ton of podcasts and an abundance of radio, and there's so much that you hear and so many incredible stories, including conversations that you just had with Adam Grant, like great conversation, extraordinary perspectives. But at the end of it, you've got a story, and maybe you share it with your partner or your children at the end of the day. But often it's something that just kind of gets stored away and becomes part of life experience. I think back when I was an undergraduate at Swarthmore College in Philadelphia, I did a great deal of study, actually an unusual path, but I ended up with one of my majors being Black Studies, which was primarily a focus on civil rights and civil rights legislation. I studied Martin Luther King, and in his letter from a Birmingham jail, he talked about this idea of action antidotes, that the only way that we can really kill the poison of anything from segregation or racism to apathy is through action. And so by baking that into the podcast, baking that into the Potluck Society, I get to take an opportunity to say, do something little. Like, if you've enjoyed this at all, do something little and make your community a better place, make your life a little bit happier, and influence those around you.
You can download the Potluck Society podcast on your favorite podcast app, and that includes iTunes. Hugh Weber, thanks for being here again today.
Thanks for having me, Laurie.